Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Simon here. Welcome back. In the last episode, Alex and I spoke about flow and how to get more of it in your everyday life. Thank you to everyone who got in touch after that episode. Appreciate your kind words. And there were also a few requests for me to revisit the moments when I discussed flow with some of the athletes that came up during our conversation. So the likes of Johnny Wilkins and Goldie Sayers and Frankie Dettori. So I've pulled together a selection of clips from my interviews with those people and some others during which they talk about their heightened experiences during flow. So do listen out for how people talk about that sense of being there while simultaneously not being there, as it is very revealing. Now, as we discussed in the last episode, during flow, time distorts and your sense of self disappears. So the question is, if your sense of self or your sense of me can disappear, just how real is it? So with all that in mind, you are about to hear from, in the following order, Johnny Wilkinson, former F1 world champion Damon Hill, Frankie Dettori, Goldie Sayers and Joss Butler, all talking about their experiences of flow. I hope you enjoy, and then do consider listening back to the last episode in which Alex and I spoke, as I already mentioned, about how to bring more flow into your everyday life. So yeah, you mentioned there, so 2003, that moment. Yeah, you've described the infamous moment where you kicked the goal and brought a tear to my eye and many other people's as almost observing yourself, there being that sense of Johnny isn't here, it just happens, and a kind of peace came over you. So yeah, can you just describe what that was like then?
I think it's sort of going on my recollection from what was quite a long time ago now, unfortunately. I got more and more involved as the play went on. So from the line out, I was stood before the line out waiting for the ball, waiting for the ball to be thrown in. So there's that kind of like, geez, can we just get on with this kind of feeling? And the ball came to me and I gave it to Mike Catt, ran in, and then I'm sort of moving around to see what happens next. And at that point, I'm starting to get a bit more involved and thinking, well, hold on, we're not going anywhere here. Am I going to have a long drop goal from all way back here? The guys are trying to get into position, take it up. Matt Dawson makes a break. As we're chasing him down the field, you're getting more and more involved. The crowd are picking up. Suddenly I'm looking now, instead of thinking, am I going to hit my drop goal? I'm now thinking, where can I go to score the try? Can I help Matt Dawson here or whatever? Then the guys start going to the next ruck and the next ruck. And now I've lost that sense of, do I need to kick a drop goal? What am I going to do? And I'm now watching just what's happening. You know, Neil Back passes the ball to Martin Johnson, takes the ball. I'm watching Martin Johnson. I'm looking at him thinking, I'm watching every move he makes. Is he going to get the ball back? How's he done that? How's he done that? Where are the guys coming from? I see Matt Dawson get into place and I'm stood there. And again, I'm not thinking about the drop guard. I'm now just stood watching Matt Dawson thinking, here comes the ball. I'm feeling the ball hit my hands. I'm no longer thinking I've got a drop guard to do it. I'm just feeling the ball. And then I set the ball down, drop it. And as it drops, I see it drop and the ball turns ever so slightly towards me and forwards. Ever so slightly. If it goes too far towards me, it'll change the kick completely, but it's gone just a tiny bit, which means I'm going to miss the sweet spot of the ball. I can sense this the whole time. I'm going to miss the sweet spot of the ball, but I'll catch it just underneath and just around the and on a small solid point of the ball, which means it'll spin a lot quicker. It'll go a lot shorter, but it'll be a hell of a lot straighter. And so as it drops between the legs, I can feel my leg going back, but it's not me kicking it. It's a knowing of it. And as I hit the ball, the sensation is what I thought it was, you know, almost what I knew it was going to be. And I'm watching the ball go and it's tracing a line. And it's only when the ball gets halfway through the other side, so it's a few yards past the other side of the post, that I then realise what the hell's happened. And then me kicks in, yeah. All of a sudden you comes back. And I do this half-hearted sort of celebration, which is almost just disbelief because I haven't been there to really see it. And now I've come out of it to try and celebrate it, which I then stop myself knowing that these guys in the golden shirts have gotten back into this game so many times. And if anyone's capable of doing it, they are. So I'm now running around going, just catch the damn kickoff and get this ball off the field now. You know, let's finish this job. But yeah. It was a sense of deeper and deeper involvement, which led it to be not a memory that I treasure because I don't have that much memory of it, but just an experience which gave me a glimpse, if you like, of life a little bit outside the boundaries of what I thought was possible.
A glimpse of reality.
A glimpse of something bigger, yeah.
Now, obviously, so 2003, as we've established, I've left that sweary answer phone message. Mm-hmm. You know, you've hugged Will Greenwood. He got the shot. Everyone's happy. You've lifted the trophy. There's a picture of you walking down the tunnel with all these arms towards you and you've got your head bowed and you're going off. And obviously, you know, you'd convince yourself that the stress led to the performance.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But then you spoke about not long after being kind of as empty as you'd ever been.
I think that's it. Just from a sort of society perspective, you're in a way a little bit promised this idea that at the end of this suffering will come the joy, you know, whether it's the next car, whether it's the the job, whether it's the family, whether it's the retirement. I think it's quite interesting now because life's added, or the mind's added another one now, which stops you ever facing this because it says, well, after I'm gone, my legacy will make me happy. You're kind of like, oh, now I'm screwed. I'm never gonna face this in my lifetime. But the idea that all this doing will end in being is something that's, I think, embedded a little bit in society over here. The idea that becoming someone will reveal all your potential. You know, what I acquire in my life is going to give me potential. Almost like there is actual potential in a World Cup that you lift, you know, that it has this almost source of energy that when you lift it, you get embedded with this joy. I mean,
like He-Man's sword.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it didn't work that way for me. And I was so pleased to have gotten to that stage early enough to realise that, geez, you know, if it's not there, then surely maybe my potential is actually in me and I should look that way. And it's kind of like the obvious thing of, you know, what you're looking for is where you're looking from type idea, that you sort of end up going, I've got to start maybe understanding that I started off this life as a young kid who just wanted to know all I could be, and I've become a guy that just wants to have everything, have the reputation, have the status, have the cup, have the life and the whatever. And when I had it all, I was like, oh geez, I've stopped being all I can, trying to be all I can be, and I've started trying to control the world to have this amazing thing. And it was, you know, the next morning it kicked in. You wake up and, you know, you sort of, it's not, you know, we're waiting for that big change. You're waiting for, you know, whatever it is to...
Euphoria, yeah.
And it just wasn't there. But dangerous is that habit is that, you know, suddenly I started thinking, well, I'll tell you why it's not there. It's because we haven't won two in a row.
Yeah.
So we need to get busy on 2007. And sure enough, we almost got there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still, it's, but even so, yeah, like I said, that drive is amazing. The drive is, and the single focus is so powerful. But the energy behind it, when you're, you know, when you're doing it out of passion and excitement between the two whistles, it's beautiful. When you're doing it out of stress and need, and it has to be, you know, or else, what if I let some? It can be the most debilitating and destructive thing.
Just really quickly, because I only sort of became aware of this when reading your book, your view of the official narrative of the Ayrton Senna accident, which is that the steering column broke, but you're of the opinion that actually he just lost control of the car at a time when the car was hard to control.
Yeah, you can't convince people of things they want to believe, and they, a lot of people were very devoted to Ayrton, and they don't like to think of their heroes being in any way having any flaws. So it's a touchy subject, you know, and I don't want to offend anybody, but all I'm saying is I went through the science of it. I went through the data. I went through the analysis of what was available to me of the accident. And to this day, I still believe that he was pushing himself, as he always did, beyond the limits in order to win. And that's so, to my mind, Ayrton was always on the edge of his abilities, and that's why he was Ayrton Senna. That's what made him great. And I think there's always a moment where that defeats you, that somehow you go over the edge. And I just think, you know, I did drive exactly the same car through exactly the same corner on exactly the same weekend as he did. So I kind of think I've got some valid viewpoint on that. And I don't see why it's to the detriment of in any way of Ayrton to suggest that he over drove the car under ridiculously difficult circumstances, because that was his nature. He would not be defeated. We talked earlier about, you know, things that are impossible. He was determined to win that race, and he determined to win it also for Roland Ratzenberger, who died the previous day. And I have been told that he was carrying an Austrian flag with him. So his emotions were extremely high on that weekend. And also, he'd not scored any points and he needed to win that race. And there was a number of factors that made it conspired against him, I think. And I think that he ultimately, it was very unlucky what happened in the accident. So, yeah, that's really why I went through that process in the book, to try and just give a few added facts or views that maybe hadn't been aired.
And I completely agree with you. I mean, who's better placed to comment on it than you? And in no way is it disrespectful to Ayrton. And Ayrton was someone who had a clearly developed spiritual side, and he felt very in touch with kind of his mission, as it were, in terms of the effect he was having in Brazil, particularly at that time. Yeah. And everyone who speaks about Ayrton talks about him having this almost mystical quality about him.
Yeah.
And what I found fascinating was you could almost argue you got in touch with that mystical quality later in the season after Ayrton had died, and you had taken on the mantle and were pushing Schumacher hard that season. And you spoke about, in your mind, asking for his help in one particular race and then promptly having something akin to an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, so the story goes that the championship was, as you say, keenly fought. I wouldn't say that I was pushing Michael. I think he was pushing me. But anyway, I was trying to catch Michael up in the championship, and it was tough because he turned out to be the greatest racing driver that ever raced. So at the time, he hadn't won a championship. So we knew we were up against a good driver. We didn't know quite how good. But it came down to a race that I needed to win in order to stop him winning the championship. In Suzuka, and it was a wet race conditions, and I'd basically run out of ideas. You know, he'd been catching me on the clock because it was an aggregate race. So I wasn't actually with him on the same piece of tarmac, but I needed to keep a buffer of 6 or so seconds. And he'd been whittling it down, you know, it had been going 10, you know, 9, 8, 7 until the last lap. And I knew he'd get me if I didn't pull something out of the hat. So I literally remember saying, look, I'm done. Ayrton, if you're up there, you know, I could do with a hand. And I don't know what happened, but it was like unlocking some blockage in my mind. And the next thing I know, I am driving out of my skin, literally. And it was almost as if I was not driving the car. Something else was driving the car. It was probably me, but it was probably the me that I'd been kind of keeping protected from, you know. It's the fear of completely letting go of yourself in a situation. And I was conscious I had the talent to do things, but I wasn't probably confident enough to let the talent do the work. So something was unlocked in that moment, and I just was driving out of my skin. It was absolutely awesome, but it was also quite terrifying.
I spoke to Johnny Wilkinson the end of last year, and he gave an account of when he kicked the winning drop goal in the 2003 World Cup. And it's very similar. He says that basically at some point in the run up to that drop kick, it was almost like he wasn't there and he was observing everything happen. And it gave him a glimpse into something bigger and actually really shaped his worldview thereafter. And it sounds like, to some degree, you have sort of explained it to yourself. But at the time, did it feel mystical?
Well, what can you say? I asked for help and I got it. You know, I mean, what can you say about that? I mean, honestly, we'd felt that we were racing for Ayrton that season. We were, you know, he was part of the team. We'd lost a driver. And then we were up against Michael, and Michael was sort of seen as the villain a little bit. He'd been a bit naughty in the season, and it was too easy but in sport, that's what happens. So we thought we were fighting for Ayrton a little bit. And so I know for a fact that if you believe something, then it's possible. And we still don't know. We still haven't untapped it. And that was very much Ayrton's quest as well as a driver, was to find out what was possible.
And there's an element of surrender to it as well, isn't there?
Exactly. It's letting go.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Let's talk about then that moment where you absolutely lifted racing to another level whilst almost bankrupting the accompanying bookie industry as well. So you rode an impossible 7 winners on one day at Ascot in 1996. The last was Fujiyama Crest, 16-1, virtually a no-hoper. And you've spoken about saying that it didn't, that last one, it didn't feel like you were racing. It was more like you were an observer. And this is something I've heard with a few people when they've reached this level of performance that is just extraordinary. So can you just describe what that was like and how that felt to you?
It was mad, to be honest with you. I mean, when I got the six, I equaled the record. And that, for me, that was good enough. You know, 300 years record. Only myself, Alex Russell, Willie Carson, and Sir Gordon Richard done it. I thought, great. And this horse, Fujiyama Crest, didn't win a race for a year. It was out of form. It was 16-1, like you said. Couldn't see a win. And I remember I was walking into the parade ring before the race, and I glanced at the electronic betting screen, and it was 2-1 favor. And I was saying to myself, how crazy is this? This horse can't win. But you know what? I went out there, and I was so relaxed. I didn't put pressure on myself because I couldn't see the horse win. And probably, and that's why I probably won, because I didn't get myself in a panic, and I just rode it like I always do, and I guess the natural talent and the adrenaline or whatever other things you want to stick in there made the horse win. The crowd, just bizarre, really bizarre, like even up to now when I think back, I mean, how did we won, I really don't know. And it was mad, completely surreal.
Did it feel, you know, almost, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but almost otherworldly, almost mystical, like you were connecting with a bigger force. Was there that sense of that?
I felt numb, actually. I didn't feel like I was, felt like I was there, you know, but I wasn't there. You know, it's very hard to explain. I was, you know, that 3 hours of my life was an absolute madness. You know, from 2 o'clock to 5:30, what happened to me that day, emotionally, I cannot even put into words what happened to me that day, but it was just, you know, like I said, like an outer force from somewhere else just carried me through that day. I really don't know. It's surreal, you know, and even now it gives me goosebumps. It's been 25 years. I'm really looking back to it. What happened that day? Really.
Yeah, so I think, you know, thinking about flow, I think you can be in flow a lot, and maybe that's around, you know, having done the training, and but perhaps those experiences are primarily based on past experience and knowing what the movements are and not thinking. But there is probably what I experienced in sport occasionally was a kind of heightened awareness. And so my experience in Beijing, you know, it was awful, awful conditions, you know, no one really should have thrown that well, but, you know, it was one with pretty much a world record. I broke the British record in the first round, but I knew I only had that one round because we were told that it was going to pour with rain at 7:27 and we started at 7:20. So I knew I literally had 4.5 seconds to kind of perform effectively. And, you know, I was in great shape, but the preparation was awful. I had food poisoning. A lot went wrong. So, you know, it was quite chaotic leading up to that point. But just in terms of being in flow, just a feeling of, bearing in mind, I think the javelin actually as a, I want to say art form, but it kind of is in a way, it is almost the epitome of flow, because you cannot try at any point. And that was what was so challenging, but also so lovely training for it, was the fact that you have to get out of the way of it. So you can't, the minute you think, and you will have thoughts that will come and go during that 4.5 seconds or whatever length of, you know, elite performance throw was, mine was like about 4.45 seconds. But the actual throw itself might last, you know, 1/16 of a second, But when I was, you know, performing really well, that 1/16 of a second, you know, I'm convinced you can play with time and stretch it and stuff, because I could just, you know, it was like it was sort of happening to me, I guess. And I listened to Johnny Wilkinson's podcast, and that feeling of, you know, being aware that it's happening, but, you know, it's almost happening to you in a way. But just that 1/16 of a second probably felt like, I don't know, 20 seconds or something. And the only way at the time I could describe it, because I hadn't learned about, you know, non-duality and everything, was in layman's terms. And I feel like a bit of an idiot saying it now, having listened to Rupert, but having watched the film Limitless, where Bradley Cooper kind of takes this pill and almost the whole world kind of opens up, or he can access another side of his brain. I mean, that's sort of what it feels like, which is, you know, possibly why I'll never, you know, turn to drugs, because I feel like I've experienced that already. And maybe that's what people love about drugs. I don't know. But, you know, yeah, so it's a sort of heightened, very, very heightened state. And then, but I wonder whether in order to access that, if we're talking about everybody being connected and this sort of universal energy, when you're in a stadium where the thing that you're sort of competing for means so much to you, but it more importantly means so much to the whole audience, then I think maybe, I don't know, this is my hypothesis, but maybe you can access that to another level. It sort of all starts at the start of the throw, which for me is sort of was a pre-throw kind of routine where, you know, I'd kind of skip to the back of the run up, sort of create a bit of energy within myself. And then obviously in an Olympics, you've got 60, 80,000 people, kind of really intense environment. So then what I would, as a routine, just bring it very, very internal. So take some deep breaths, then almost take that energy to I used to sort of use my sort of stomach, I guess, and then feel my feet, just so I had some sort of, I just calming everything down effectively. So just completely, yeah. So you're effectively, I guess it's, I didn't know it at the time, but I was effectively kind of doing a mindfulness kind of exercise in a very, very heightened state. And then I'd run through what I was about to do, or like a perfect, in inverted commas, throw, or what I wanted to happen. So I'd see it in my mind. And I'm quite, you know, from a musical family, so I basically say a rhythm to myself. It looks like I'm talking to myself. But the rhythm of the throw, which is effectively, if you were to put a stopwatch on it in my mind, it would be exactly the same time as the throw that I was about to do. So see it, feel it in my body. And that's the point at which you just have to let go of everything and let it happen. And then you do it. So see it, sort of feel it in your body, having visualized it, then do it. So whether what you've just about to do or doing is actually what you've just visualized, or whether it is actually what you've done, I don't know. But there was just a moment, because when you're performing, you have to almost kid yourself that you're about to do something great, because you have to quieten your own brain and thoughts. So often I think I would do this quite funny thing where I'd start to hear the pattern of my feet. That's so I knew sort of 3 steps in whether it was going to be a decent throw or not. But kind of halfway down, sometimes I'd go, and I remember doing it actually in Beijing, I don't know if it's on the first round or not, but I go, oh yeah, to kind of convince myself that I was going to be, you know, about to be great. But I did, I'm being very honest. I don't think I've ever said that before anywhere. And then you sort of have to get into, so my throw is effectively like 16 steps. It's not very long, but all you can relate it to, I think, if, you know, to most people listening, if they've played golf, it's a bit like trying to hit a perfect golf drive off a 25 meter run up. There's a lot of variables that can get in the way, not least yourself. And there is time to think, but you know, that's absolutely a no-go. But there's a point in the javelin, in the penultimate sort of stride, we call it like the impulse, which is effectively just time in the air to kind of create this slot. It's what it sort of feels like effectively. And I think it was probably at that moment when I'm like, oh yeah, that feels nice. But it was like that speed in my mind. And it wasn't me judging it. Well, I suppose it is you judging it, but it's just, it is an awareness. It's just awareness, really. And you have to base all your training, certainly in javelin, or I did, whether rightly or wrongly, on feelings, because you're taking on information from a coach or whatever and building this throw. over a period of years and years and years. So you know what kind of good feels like, effectively, really. So yeah, I guess I just remember this moment where I'm like, oh, this is, it's almost like joyful. I'm like, oh, this is fun. And, or you'll feel quite at peace, I guess, and know it's about to be, is a knowing, I guess, that it's about to be good, which is why people always say, you know, do you know that it's going to go a long way when it leaves your hand? It's like, well, you sort of know that, you know, 15 meters back, but you definitely know in that slot position for me. So, and then that's at that point, you really have to get out of the way of it. Yeah. So yeah, and I definitely had moments. I probably, in my best performances, actually, that was probably the most flowing, I guess, I was. And yeah, I would have been in flow to a degree in other performances, and certainly moments in training as well. But there's definitely been moments that have been on a sort of slightly different stratosphere kind of thing.
When someone is bowling the ball at you at 90 mile an hour plus, and you know, there's such a difference watching it on TV to being, first of all, watching it from the stands, and then I imagine even more being out there in the middle. You know, the first time I remember seeing a match live, I was like, couldn't believe how fast they're coming. Is it totally instinct? Are you almost surprised at what you're doing with the ball sometimes?
Sometimes, and I think sort of for me, that purest form of batting, like I say, is when your subconscious is in complete control and you're almost a spectator of your own body almost, aren't you? You know, I think that for me is the zone, sort of, you know, that you have no real thoughts and it's complete trust in your body and in your practice and in everything that you've trained for, that whatever this ball comes down, I will react, you know, my body will do it for me if I allow it to. So I think that's sort of the purest form of batting for me. And I think trust is a huge part of that. You know, you have to trust that you've done the work and you've done the ugly training at times, you know, to face 90 miles an hour in the nets or some uncomfortable practices is never very fun, you know, actually. But if you can get through that and in the practice and it takes you, you know, in that game situation, you know, you've done the work and have given myself the best chance of succeeding. And then allowing, like I say, allowing your talent to do the job for you, allowing you all those, that muscle memory and that subconscious thought to take over.
I love that sort of idea. You practice and practicing hard and refining your skills and putting yourself under uncomfortable situations in practice and then going out and ultimately letting go and surrendering. That seems to be a real formula for success in across all sports and in most things, actually. I mean, for me, if I think of preparing for a podcast, I know if I do the prep, if I do the work and then you let go, it's such a formula for success, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, think, you know, listening to podcasts and reading certain things and looking at different sports, that, like you say, it's that common trend that, you know, the majority of successful people do. And so you look at certain businesses and why this guy is so successful. It's like you say, it's that they do the work and then they let things happen and they have trust that it will happen and they trust the people around them that they've done their work. And, you know, especially in team sports and sort of like you say that, you know, we've all done the stuff, we're all prepared, we're good to go, let's now go out and let it happen.
Just a quick thing on perspective. You're well known for having F it written on your bat. Is that still the case and where did that come from?
Yeah, it is still the case and I've had it on there for a while actually. And I go back to my sort of T20 debuts and stuff. I struggled a little bit to start with, and Mark Borden was the England psychologist at the time. Oh, yeah. I remember sitting down with him in a hotel in Manchester and just saying, no, I feel like this is kind of happening and I don't feel like I'm in the best headspace when I'm at the games at the moment. And we went through a little bit of it, and almost that inverted youth, that sort of arousal level stuff. Yeah. Sort of saying, where do you sit on this when you're, you know, at your best? What do you sort of, you know, when you're at your best, what do you say to yourself? And I said, I literally just say effort. And he's like, well, that, you know, that is it. Your effort mindset is pretty much you at your best. So that's the sort of thing you need to remind yourself of. How can you practice that mindset and how can you try and turn up to games and bring that into your games. And then so I started writing on the top of my handle as just a little reminder, you know, when you look down and take your guard, it's there, or if you're at the non-striker's end. And then I think over time it's taken on more meanings, like I said, about perspective. It can take on lots of that. And you know, you sit down after you got out and you look at it and you just think, effort doesn't matter that much in the grand scheme of life. Yeah. Certainly find it helps a lot around commitment, like for me. So like I say, if I'm trying to weigh up a situation in the middle and, well, this bowler's got a certain field, I feel like he's going to bowl this, or I need to play this shot. And when that guy on your shoulder is sort of coming in and saying, yeah, but what if? It's almost, that's the time when I say, effort, trust yourself. You know, I think trust in yourself and your decision-making and allowing yourself to commit to those decisions. So that note on the top of my handle sort of taken on that meaning as well. So certainly just having a visual tool of it, as it's always sort of there, just I think has been a big plus for me. But certainly, yeah, it's taken on a few meanings at different points.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I would be delighted to hear your questions and thoughts as always. Get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com, or on social media.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.